This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. David Rutledge with you once again for a conversation this week about how we might best approach the hardness of life. Because the hardness of life is universal. We all experience it. And of course, for some of us, life is hard just every now and then. For others, it's hard most of the time, maybe all of the time. But there does seem to be a good chance that over the next few decades, we're going to be witnessing a rising tide of adversity that's going to affect everyone, whether it's the direct impact of floods or fires or storms or pandemics or the knock-on effects of these things. It's hard to see how the future isn't going to lean heavily on our resources of stoic fortitude. And so the challenge for us is going to be how to make life meaningful and rewarding in the face of whatever hardships and losses might be coming down the road. Well, my guest this week has written a rather wonderful book that explores this question, and it's my favourite kind of book because it combines personal experience and a sort of immediacy with a great, big, glorious, wide-ranging sweep of philosophy. The title is Life is Hard, How Philosophy Can Help Us Find Our Way, and the author is Kieran Setia, who's Professor of Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Kieran, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
I want to begin by putting your book into what seems to me an interesting context, because over the past few months, I've done a couple of interviews with authors who have written books on the virtues of what you might call modest ambitions when it comes to the good life. One book was called The Not-So-Good Life. The other one was titled In Praise of Failure, which gives you an idea of what they were about. Now we have Life is Hard, which is, you know, in many respects, it's a different kind of book. But what it has in common, I think, with these other books is this idea that living well and living our best life are not necessarily the same thing. And in fact, the pursuit of one's best life may even be counterproductive to living well. And I wonder if you agree that that seems to be a zeitgeisty sort of idea at the moment, and what you think might be driving it.
I do think it's very much in the air. One of the things I suggest in the book is that it has very deep roots. So I go back to Plato and Aristotle, whose visions of justice and the good life start with ideals. You know, Plato's utopia, his Kallipolis, the beautiful city in the Republic, or Aristotle's vision of the highest good, a life lacking in nothing, the kind of life of the gods. So I think there is a deep intellectual trajectory here. And I think in a way, you can see why it would make sense to say, if I want to live well, I'll start by describing the best life and just see how close I can get to that. But actually, I think often it's just demoralizing to look at the best life and recognize you're not going to get close to it. And it's not always true that the best thing to do in imperfect conditions is to get it, sort of keep trying for an impossible ideal. As to why it's culturally sort of vibrant now, this sort of resistance is vibrant now, part of that, I think, turns on longstanding aspects of American culture that have sort of spread to the rest of the world, which is a kind of picture of human life as powered by positive thinking, as something in which there's a kind of standard of success, often financial, often social, that we should all be aspiring to, and that we have only ourselves to blame if we don't achieve it. And then I think if you add on top of that the way in which social media has meant that we're constantly curating a sense of ourselves, our own excellence, our own achievement to the world, and seeing everyone else's self-portrayal in that light, I think those kinds of recent cultural developments probably make it feel especially urgent to resist the idea that living well is about anything more than living a good enough life. I think one way to think about what I'm up to in the book is asking what philosophical reflection on the good life would look like if it never lost touch with the fact that life is hard. So the moments in life, I think, when we most urgently reflect on how to live, typically are ones where we're faced with some kind of hardship. And I think those are the moments of reflection in which we have to grapple with the difficulty of life in a way that philosophy should be able to help us with. I think an analogy that is useful here is with a shift that's happened in political philosophy in the last, I guess now, 30 or so years, which is a shift from what gets called ideal to non-ideal theory. So a shift from thinking the job of political philosophy is to describe ideal justice to a vision on which the job is to identify injustice in the world around us and give us guidance in how we can make a difference. And in a way, that's how I think of my book in relation to the project of living well. The goal is to say, how can we identify and understand the ways in which life is difficult and grapple with the difficulties? And by grappling with the difficulties, aspire to have lives that are facing reality in ways that are meaningful and satisfying without being utopian or involving wishful thinking.
One thing I really like about your book is that while it is very much a work of philosophy, it's not an abstract philosophical treatise. It's grounded in your own personal experience of the hardness of life. Can you tell us a bit about that? What happened to you that animated your desire to write a book like this?
Well, the book in a way comes out of my experience with chronic pain. So I started experiencing what later got, quote, diagnosed as chronic pelvic pain when I was about 27, I think. And, you know, it's one of those diagnoses that names the symptom. It's a condition that isn't very well understood. It just involves continual unresponsive pain. It kind of fluctuates. It's mostly non-debilitating, but it can be very disruptive to sleep. And there was a period that I went through, which I think a lot of people experiencing chronic pain go through, of thinking, I'll go from doctor to doctor and we'll figure this out. For me, the great shift in coming to terms with it was really stopping that flight from doctor to doctor and thinking, okay, suppose this doesn't go away. It doesn't seem like it's going to. Well, I can have a pretty good day while experiencing some degree of physical pain. What would it mean to think about living a good life under conditions where pain is, in the most visceral, immediate way, unavoidable? And I didn't, in the end, want to write a whole book about my own experience. So there's a chapter that really focuses on my experience, a chapter on infirmity. But I did want to use it as it were, a window into the human condition, because I think whether it's chronic pain or grief or failure or loneliness, everyone is dealing with some kind of difficulty, the kind of difficulty that, you know, makes it hard to see how to live a decent or a satisfying life. And I wanted to use my experience as a way to investigate what philosophical reflection might look like if it really took that seriously.
And where was, or where is happiness in that search, if you want to call it that? Is happiness something that you were hoping to recover or incorporate into your life, even though you were dealing with this pain? I'm sort of interested in the role that you see happiness and the search for happiness taking in all of this.
Well, I'm not opposed to happiness. I mean, who would be? But I do think there's a key distinction here that structures my thinking, which is the distinction between happiness and living well. I mean, it's the kind of distinction between a state of mind, in effect, feeling good, and actually engaging with the world in meaningful ways. And philosophers like to draw this kind of distinction using kooky thought experiments. So they'll imagine someone plugged into a simulation, being fed a stream of consciousness that simulates an ideal life. They have no idea it's fake, but they're not actually in touch with reality or with anything but the machine. They might be perfectly happy, but they're not living a good life. They're not living a life of meaningful engagement with the world or with other people. And when you draw that distinction, I think it's clear that the goal should be living well. It should be trying to live the way we should in treating ourselves and in treating other people. And then happiness is, in the good case, a byproduct of that. It's something that we get as a, in a way, a side effect of living a good enough life. And that's a kind of contrast that structures, for instance, our relationship to grief, where when we get away from philosophical thought experiments, I think grief is one of the cases in ordinary life where the distinction between just feeling happy and living well is most vivid, because the sadness or pain of grief isn't the kind of thing that ideally we just wish away, that somehow it would just be better for us if we just didn't feel anything when people we love died. That's a case where it's vivid that living well, engaging with reality properly, may involve some degree of unhappiness.
A big problem I have with the whole happiness discourse is that it can foster this sentiment that And you touched on this earlier, that if you're miserable, if your life is hard, it's because you haven't cracked the happiness code. And maybe that's your fault, right? Because the message of the happiness industry is that anyone can be happy. You just got to put the work in. Whereas if you start from the position that life is hard for everyone and that happiness is rare and often just a matter of luck, then you have compassion sort of getting in on the ground floor, so to speak. It becomes fundamental to your dealings with other people, and that's more useful if you're interested in justice, which you are. Do you think that there's something about the pursuit of happiness that draws our attention away from issues like justice and compassion, or can do?
I definitely think it does. I mean, if you are thinking about philosophical self-help, which I suppose is the kind of genre in which this book is operating, if you think of the goal of self-help as happiness, you really are thinking of something that is a private possession. It's your state of mind. It's how you feel. As the thought experiment of being plugged into the simulation suggests, it could be entirely independent of what's happening with anyone else. As soon as you shift from thinking the goal of self-help is to be happy and start thinking the goal is to live a good life, well, what's a good life? It's a life that's good enough. It's engaged with myself and the world in the ways it should be to the extent that it can be. Then you start thinking, well, if I'm trying to live the kind of life I should live, a good life, it can't just be about me. It has to be about how I treat other people too. And I suppose you could have an incredibly selfish conception of what living well is, but you're not forced to think in this narrowly solipsistic way about living well. Once you start thinking of it as engagement with the world rather than just a state of mind. So I think the shift away from focusing on happiness to focusing on meaningful engagement is already a way of opening the door to a picture on which whether I'm living well is just not independent in the end of my relationships to other people and the kind of world I inhabit.
On the face of it, your book has a sort of a stoic flavor, or at least a flavor of what often gets called stoicism. I'm hedging a little bit here because I interviewed someone a while back who said that what generally passes for stoicism these days actually sort of grievously misrepresents what the ancient Stoics were on about. So I'm always a little careful bandying the term around. But all that aside, how does your analysis of and your approach to the good life differ from what you understand stoicism to be?
So there's something very much in common with Stoicism, as you said, namely a focus on adversity in life. The Stoics were very adamant that the starting point for philosophy should be the challenge of coping with the ways in which life at least seems to be difficult. I think the biggest contrast is that Stoicism still has, despite its attention to adversity, a kind of optimism or a kind of idealism about how satisfactorily we can cope with adversity, about how much it's up to us to make ourselves happy or to give ourselves good lives, whatever the conditions. So in a way, the key Stoic idea is that if you can't control it, let go, just detach from it. And if you can control it, do what needs to be done to make it go well. On that vision, if you're not living the kind of life you should be living, it's on you, because the stuff that's out of your control is irrelevant, and the stuff that's under your control, you should be fixing. But actually, I think that idea that we shouldn't care about what we can't control is an impoverishment of our capacity to truly engage with the world. So my view is that real engagement sometimes puts us in the position where there are things that we must care about that we can't control. I think grief is the example where this comes out most sharply in Stoic thinking, where you'll find a Stoic thinker like Epictetus saying, you know, remember your wife is mortal. And then when she dies, you'll think, well, what did I expect? She was going to live forever? You'll be fine. But actually railing against even things you can't control, like the death of people you love, is, I think, part of a genuinely loving attachment to them. And I don't think we'd be better off without the kind of love that involves that kind of frustration and anguish at what we can't control. I mean, on the issue of how contemporary Stoicism relates to ancient Stoicism, I'm not an expert on the ancient Stoic tradition, but my understanding is that there is a kind of what philosophers call a theodicy in Stoicism. There's a picture on which the difficulties of life are We can reconcile ourselves to the difficulties of life because we can understand the role of God or Zeus or reason in the cosmos. And I think contemporary Stoics don't take that part of Stoicism seriously, but it seems very important. I think if you really thought God was in charge and God's reason is behind everything that happens, even the things that seem terrible, it would be easier to say, okay, this looks bad, but I'm not going to worry about it. I think the real problem is when Stoicism gets detached from this metaphysical baggage that no one in contemporary Stoic circles really takes seriously. And then I think it doesn't really make sense as a coherent philosophy.
This is the Philosopher's Zone on Radio National and the ABC Listen app with me, David Rutledge, and I'm joined this week by Kieran Settier. He's Professor of Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and we're talking about his latest book, Life is Hard: How Philosophy Can Help Us Find Our Way. I really like the chapter in your book where you talk about failure. And you write there about narrative and how our tendency to think of our lives as describing some sort of linear narrative lies at the root of our perception of failure. Can you tease that out a bit? What's the problem there?
I think the challenge here is that if you think of your life as a narrative that has a challenge to overcome and then you succeed or fail, and that's the defining aspect of your life, that's what makes you you, that gives you your identity. It's not just that you risk failure, risk a kind of life-defining failure, because you might succeed. It's also that it involves a kind of narrowing of focus. So one of the problems with this narrative conception of life, at least if we think of narrative in linear, monolithic terms, is that it tends to blinker us to all the little moments of interaction, all the other little things we do and experience that actually make up the texture for most of us of a good enough, meaningful enough life. I think there's a way in which focusing on narrative might be harmless if only we had a wider vision of what kinds of shapes narrative could take. There's a wonderful book by the critic Jane Allison called Meander, Spiral, Explode, in which she talks about the varieties of narrative, the fact that some involve repetition or branching from a central core or a kind of bricolage of different moments. I think if we thought of storytelling in our lives in that way, it would be expansive enough that it wouldn't limit us in the way that the linear hero's narrative tends to limit us. So I do think there's a real danger there. I think there's also a danger in that the kind of narratives we're encouraged to tell, if we give ourselves the single narrative, are often ones that are being imposed on us by cultural ideals of achievement, often financial, often competitive career success, that in broader social terms are, I think, destructive, and destructive for the people who buy into them, and also destructive for the people who come out on the losing side.
There's also the way we think about projects, and you write about how our perception of failure is linked to the way that we do that. Tell me about how our projects can affect the way that we think about success versus failure.
So this is a key idea for me in relation to really everything we do. And it's true, even if we're not focused on one giant narrative, we're just looking at all the little enterprises we engage in from day to day, there's a tendency to see the value of what we're doing in project-like terms. I call this the telic orientation, telic coming from the Greek word telos, where a telic activity is one that has an endpoint, something you've achieved. So it might be getting a promotion at work or writing a book or getting married. And the problem with projects, not that they don't have value, is that when you're valuing a project, what you really want, the completion, is always in the future. So you're frustrated, it's not here yet. And then the moment you achieve it, well, that's done, it's over, what next? You need another project. And your way of engaging with projects is to take these things that are giving structure and shape to your life, and in effect, take this thing you love and try to destroy it, try to extinguish it and kick it out of your life. I don't think projects are valueless, but I do think we tend to overinvest in them. And it's very important to bring into view a different kind of activity, what I call atelic activities, because they don't have this kind of terminal point. So that might be talking about philosophy, or it might be parenting, or it might be just going for a walk, where there isn't an endpoint at which you're done, you've achieved it, there's no more you can do. And so there isn't this sense of being at a distance from what you really value and then putting it in the past. If what you want is to be talking about philosophy, yeah, we're doing it right now. Or if you want to be going for a walk, and you're going for a walk, you have what you want right now. You're, as I say in the book, you're in a way living in the present. And I think that is the truth behind, or a truth behind, that self-help slogan about the importance of living in the present, is that we need to appreciate more fully the value of atelic activities, the value of the process, not just the projects of completion, of getting one thing after another done. And I do think that changes our relationship to failure, because it's in projects that we have this sort of definitive succeed-fail structure. Although it's not always easy to engage in an atelic activity, it doesn't have that shape.
Do you think that cultural focus that we have on whether our projects succeed or fail, and our tendency to see our lives as narratives, you know, some kind of hero's journey, which may not turn out to be that kind of story at all, are these the kinds of things that result in midlife crisis? I'm interested in your discussion of midlife crisis, very familiar milestone in so many lives. Is that what it comes down to when these ideas about projects and life's journey, they really sort of, it all comes to the crunch?
Well, that's certainly how it was for me. When I wrote my previous book was called Midlife, and it really did come out of my own experience at a certain point in the academic career path of realizing that I was looking forward to just, you know, one more class to teach, one more paper to write and publish. And it all seemed worthwhile and yet hollow. And I think the hollowness of that treadmill is the hollowness of the project-driven life. And I think that is a characteristic form of midlife crisis. I don't think it's exclusive to midlife. I think you can have that kind of malaise earlier or later. And I don't think it's the only midlife crisis. I think there are also problems of regret and the way in which life is consumed by what needs to be done, and there's very little space for the kinds of things that don't need to be done but have value anyway. So I think that the midlife crisis is really many midlife crises. But I do think, yes, that a central one for many people is about becoming too project-driven and unable to appreciate the ongoing process of what they're doing as a center of value.
You mentioned regret there, and one thing about my own experience of midlife is that I sometimes find myself thinking about things that I've always wanted to do that I now realize I will probably never do. And that's a relatively new thing for me. How do you address regret in your book, and that feeling like a door has closed that will probably most likely never open again?
I think this is something that people, again, face at midlife, but can face at earlier and later points too. I think in a way, my sense of the kind of cognitive philosophical therapy that's useful comes from recognizing how unavoidable that is, and how its unavoidability is a side effect of something good. So one way to think about this is to ask, like, what would your relationship to life have to be like to avoid that sense that you're missing out on things? It would have to be that you really just don't have a wide enough range of interests, or there aren't enough things of value in the world for you to have the sense that the world is offering up more than you can possibly fit into your life. And when you put it that way, the thought, well, I wish I didn't have to miss out on things, starts to look a lot less attractive. A life in which you can't miss out on things is a life where the world doesn't offer up enough things for your life to a surplus that goes beyond what your life can contain. And no one should really want that. So I think it is, in a way, regrettable that we are inevitably going to miss out on good things. But it's also a symptom of the fact that we have the capacity to appreciate so many things, and that the world offers enough options and enough possibilities for us to recognize that we can't exhaust it. And when you see it that way, well, I don't think it solves the problem, but it at least mitigates the sense that there's some alternative that would be better than the condition of missing out that we all experience.
Well, Kieran, I just want to finish with a question about particular philosophers, because none of our listeners will be surprised to hear that when you look at the roll call of philosophers that you discuss in the book, they tend to be the gloomy ones. We've got Sartre in there, Camus, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Schopenhauer. Who would be two among those that you would particularly recommend to anyone who is struggling with the hardship of life, not just for an analysis of that hardship, but for some answers or some useful strategies, if you like?
Well, I'm going to give two very different answers. One is tricky, which is Diogenes the Cynic. And it's tricky because almost nothing survives of what he wrote. But what we do have are stories about Diogenes. He was a contemporary of Plato. He lived in a barrel on the streets of Athens. He was a mocking philosopher. He wasn't a cynic in the negative sense. He was a cynic in the sense of being a critic of the pomposity of Athenian society and of most philosophy. And the reason why I think Diogenes is a good place to turn for consolation is that he's very funny. He, you know, one of the famous stories about him is that Alexander the Great came to meet him in Corinth and stood in front of him while Diogenes was sunbathing and said, "Diogenes, I've come to see you. I'll do anything. What do you want?" And Diogenes said, "I want you to get out of my sunlight." You know, that's the kind of attitude he had to power. So I would recommend Diogenes just for the punchlines. The other philosopher I would recommend is also in a way tricky, and it's Iris Murdoch. And she's a very big influence on how I approach the difficulties of life in Life is Hard. Her vision of what philosophy should be is attention to reality, sort of close description of the world that orients us to it. She has a kind of literary sensibility, and that's something I try to carry into my investigations of loneliness and grief. And she is a philosopher whose work I find genuinely consoling. It's a little tricky to access at first. Her best essays are in a very short book called The Sovereignty of Good. And it's, you know, you could read it in an afternoon. It's 120 pages. It starts off dense with references to her contemporaries in 1950s Oxford. But if you give into it and just run with her ideas, her reflections on the centrality of love to ethics, the centrality of attention, the relationship between art and morality are something I turn to in moments of depression. She's the rare philosopher whose work I read for genuine solace and emotional uplift. And I think she's someone that I would recommend to anyone to read.
Kieran Setia is Professor of Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His book is Life is Hard, How Philosophy Can Help Us Find Our Way. It's so good, and you can find publication details on the Philosopher's Zone website. You can also access this and all of our past episodes via the ABC Listen app, so go and check that out, and I hope you'll join me next time. I'm David Rutledge. Bye for now.